Hey, what is going on? It is Crypto Bobby. Hope you are having a great day, great night, wherever you're watching or listening in from. Just got back from Prague. I was out at ETH DevCon for the past week or so. Apologies for the lack of content. My laptop and recording equipment got left in New York, but I am back in New York and looking forward to pumping out a lot of good content. Namely, I got the Casa hold. I bought one of the first 100 batch, one of the first 100 orders of the Casa hold Bitcoin Lightning node. So I'm excited to set that up. We'll likely do an unboxing review video of sorts so you guys could see if that's worth the time. Bought it out of my own pocket so you can see if it's maybe worth checking out on your own as well. We'll also be publishing a bunch of the content and videos from NAC3 that was out in San Francisco. And today, want to get this interview out to you. This was a conversation that I had with Miles Snyder, who is the CEO of Aurora EOS, block producer. Myself, personally, I have no position in EOS, long, short, nothing. And I am relatively ignorant when it comes to EOS as a whole. And I got a chance to meet Miles before he started an EOS block producer. I think I kind of got along well with him, really understood a lot of what he was talking about, and was excited to talk to him more once he ended up starting Aurora EOS. So this conversation is really just about kind of the state of EOS in general, dApps, and there's a lot of controversy just in general about EOS, specifically when it comes to there was, you know, the China voter collusion. There is also EOS right now beating Ethereum in terms of dApp users. We talk about some of the controversy around that and just in a general kind of laid back tone. So hope you enjoy this interview with Miles. It was a fun chat. Really enjoyed it. And let's get into it. Appreciate taking the time to join me. Thanks a lot for that, Miles. And want to kick things off with a softball question for you. I know you previously had a background as a chef, and I am an aspiring shitposter chef on Twitter and YouTube. So what is your favorite steak and method to cook it? I think that's something that the world really at this point in time needs to know.
I agree. That's actually a really important question. I was hoping you would ask. So without a doubt, my favorite steak is a ribeye. Particularly, I prefer a grass-fed, grass-finished ribeye. And my favorite way to do it, I really like to cook ribeye at home. I don't have a large grill at this point because it doesn't really work with my apartment. But I think doing a ribeye on a cast iron is actually an excellent way to do it. So I usually do it with like a little bit of butter and a little bit of olive oil, get the pan ripping hot, sear it on both sides. With all I put on it is really good sea salt. Give it a nice sear on both sides, and then finish it in the oven. And usually before I put it in the oven, I put like another knob of butter in there and some rosemary.
Yeah,
and then
he's a pro.
Pull it out and baste it in some of that rosemary butter. And that's a beautiful steak right there.
Yeah, that's definitely a damn good way to do it. And I have set off my fire alarm in my apartment doing it that way once or twice. So
every single time,
there's no way to not do it.
I have like a fan that is above my oven, and above my stove, and it never does a good enough job.
No.
You need those high temperatures to get it right. So
yeah. Oh, that's 100% true. But outside of steak, you've obviously been involved in the crypto world for a while. Would love for you to talk a little bit just about your personal background. I know you were, kind of came, I don't want to say to prominence, but a lot of people knew you for your work that you did at Multicoin Capital, and you recently moved to found a startup in the EOS ecosystem. So would love to just have you introduce your personal background a little bit here.
Yeah, definitely. So I first started, I was studying economics in college, and that's when I first started paying attention to EOS. Paying attention to crypto. I studied abroad in Argentina when I was a junior in college, and I was studying economics, and I had heard about Bitcoin, probably related to like Silk Road and stuff, kind of when everyone else heard about it, but didn't really take it very seriously. But I met an expat when I was living in Buenos Aires who was, friends with a lot of locals, and he invited me out to dinner one time and brought a friend with his to dinner, who I sat next to. And that guy was actually the CTO of Zappo, the Bitcoin custody company. Their founders are all from Argentina. And so I was asking him what he did, and he was telling me that he works with Bitcoin. And I told him that I'd heard a little bit about it, and he kind of, gave me the whole pitch. And that was when I really, quote unquote, went down the rabbit hole. Like that night at dinner, I became super interested. I remember going home and like reading all about it and stuff. And it clicked really easily for me. I think one, because I'd studied economics, but I had also had a lot of exposure to like the Austrian school of economics. Not necessarily in school, but like I had some friends who were big Austrians and had given me some books. And so that sort of, you know, the idea of like a non-government controlled currency was immediately kind of appealing. And then specifically being in Argentina and seeing everything that was going on with their currency crisis, like everyone was buying dollars on the street. No one wanted to hold pesos. A lot of people got, you know, basically the government stole their money. The banks stole their money in 2001 when they had their first major crisis. And so there was a lot of distrust of the local currency there. And, you know, seeing that, especially as an American, where we've had a pretty strong fiat currency for a long time, it was interesting to see that. And that got me even more interested in this idea of currencies that weren't controlled by the government. So I came back from study abroad. That was my senior year of college. And I ended up writing my senior thesis about cryptocurrencies, specifically focusing on their use cases in developing countries or countries with struggling economies, especially those that were like facing a lot of inflation. And so that was kind of my first foray into like research related to cryptocurrencies. So that was a very big like project that I took for most of my senior year, was doing that thesis. And was paying close attention to the industry throughout that whole time. That was like the 2014, 2015 timeframe when, you know, I think altcoins, the quote unquote altcoins, first started becoming really interesting or popular. And then it was also just it was a prolonged bear market. It was a very different time from what we're seeing nowadays. So after graduation, that's when I actually, went and worked as a chef, kind of did that as a temporary fun thing. Cause I love to cook. And it was a nice way to sort of ride out the bear market and wait until there were some really interesting opportunities in crypto. Because I knew that was what I wanted to do professionally. I just decided to put it off for a while. But I was still paying really close attention during that time. You know, watched Ethereum come online, participated in like the Augur crowd sale, for example, which was mm-hmm. really interesting because that was like long before ICOs were really a thing.
Yeah.
And, you know, watched a lot of different things develop and really had the intention to work in the space full time. And so started kind of going through my network and talking to different people, and ended up getting connected to Tashar and Kyle from Multicoin through a friend of a friend. And this was before they'd actually launched Multicoin. They were launching a fund, but hadn't done anything publicly. So I got on a phone call with those guys. We had some really good conversations. I ended up flying down to Austin, met with them, really liked their way of thinking. They were specifically looking for someone who was interested in doing research, which I had already done, and I was interested in doing more of that. Mm-hmm. So I came on board Multicoin as the first employee, led a lot of research efforts for a little over a year, and then more recently decided to launch an EOS block producer called Aurora EOS, and that's what I'm doing now.
Sure. And I think one of the interesting things, or kind of like one of the questions I have, is there seems to be like a lot of people who have, you know, left pretty, you know, what are considered stable, good jobs to work in, maybe the Bitcoin ecosystem or Ethereum ecosystem, haven't heard as much specifically about people joining the, you know, kind of EOS ecosystem, or at least I haven't. Maybe I've just been, you know, kind of deaf to it. But why did you decide to you know, go from, you know, what I think a lot of people consider a pretty pretty nice job at Multicoin and take a career risk, you know, doing something like creating an EOS block producer? Would love to kind of hear just your train of thoughts about why you felt like that was a good move.
Yeah. So I've always had a little bit of like an entrepreneurial streak. I think I always had the intention of eventually trying to do something entrepreneurial in the space. Mm-hmm. I loved working at Multicoin. It was an awesome job. Like, I really enjoyed the research side of things. I really enjoyed working with Tashar and Kyle and mm-hmm. that whole research team. But it really was, and I intended to stay there for a long time, but I think it was just that this opportunity came up and I thought it was a really good one. So I said, now's the time. You know, I think sometimes these things come up and the timing's not necessarily exactly what you thought it would be prior, but you have to take sure. advantage of that. But specifically why I chose to do this. So I was doing a lot of EOS research at Multicoin, where I released a big report about delegated proof of stake, a huge report about EOS. I wrote a lot about like the scalability trade-offs, as did Kyle and Tashar. And but I've really been following EOS since day one, because my first foray into like the altcoin world was in 2014 with BitShares. Mm-hmm. I became really interested in the idea of stable coins, having been in Argentina and seen the demand for dollars there, and as well as like the volatility of Bitcoin during that day. And BitShares was one of the first projects that was creating a decentralized stablecoin. So I learned a lot about that project and became really familiar with like delegated proof of stake, sort of the design choices of that system that allowed it to sort of be very scalable and have a lot of things that were really user friendly. And a lot of those ended up getting incorporated into EOS.
Yep.
And so I was really familiar with this design. I'd been following sort of Dan Larimer's work for a long time. And there's also a really big community of developers, believe it or not, that were involved in BitShares, were later involved in Steam, and now are building things on EOS because they're familiar with that tech stack. They like that design philosophy. And you know, I've known a lot of those developers for a long time. So I think to someone who wasn't involved in any of those projects beforehand, they might have a more skeptical view of EOS or have a harder time sort of getting on board with it. But for me, having seen that history, I had a very clear vision of how this could play out and where this could go. And I think with EOS, I just saw a particular combination of features that I felt like were really compelling for making dApps that were sort of could exist at scale and were really usable. And then I also saw, like, you know, interacting a lot with the community and talking to a lot of developers and other block producers, I just saw a lot of really cool stuff being built. I saw a lot of progress being made. And I see a future for EOS. I think there's certain use cases that really make a lot of sense there. Mm-hmm. And it kind of, I think that combined with the fact that it was the project I probably had the most personal expertise in, having done all that research and spent all that time in the community.
Sure.
That I was like, you know what, this is, I think, like a good place to focus my efforts.
Sure.
You know, I don't think it's the only project that's going to be successful by any means, but I think it will be very successful. And, you know, I kind of have expertise there. I've got great connections in that world. I built a lot of relationships there. So it's like, you know, why not try and build on that platform?
Totally. And, you know, I think for myself personally, you know, I probably spent a lot more time just Bitcoin ecosystem, Ethereum ecosystem. So I definitely have a fair degree of ignorance in EOS as a whole. So I certainly want to take this conversation to number one, fill in the gaps that I have. And then there's certainly, you know, EOS skeptics out there, people.
Yeah.
And I've even had my fair share of jokes on Twitter about EOS, but I've basically made fun of everything, including
good.
Myself.
They've been good, I think, and keep them coming.
But yeah, I mean, so I want to fill in those gaps and then also kind of, you know, provide an opportunity for you to, you know, address some of the things that people have questions on. But you know, one of the first things, and we'll even just kind of take it from one of the things you've mentioned, is, you know, you see a couple different use cases specifically where you think EOS could maybe bring quite a bit of value. Like what are those use cases in particular that excite you about, you know, somebody running on EOS? And, you know, are there any specific companies that are executing in that area right now?
Yeah, so I think that the use cases that I think are really compelling, especially in the near term for EOS, are like gaming, NFTs, decentralized exchanges, you know, potentially even security tokens. Those are probably the big ones. I think that EOS has a combination of, like, I would say a few key features. One is that it's got high scalability, so like a lot of throughput capacity and low latency. It's got no individual transaction fees. So we can kind of get into like what exactly that trade-off is, because
sure,
nothing is free. I don't want to sell it as a free blockchain, but like you don't pay for individual transactions, which is really more of like a user experience thing. Mm-hmm. You've got human readable account names. And then you've got this account system where there's these human readable account names and then different key pairs within those accounts that allows you to do all sorts of different permissions and things like that that are really interesting from like a security and usability perspective. But I think that there's a lot of use cases that are pretty interesting, but that you're only going to appeal to a very small audience if you go after like crypto native people who yeah, know what public key cryptography is and are really technical and know how to sort of use this crazy new technology. Whereas if you want to really bridge that gap and get a lot of users who aren't familiar with these things, who are just everyday users who use the app because it's useful, then I think you have to focus a lot more on usability. And I think having like high throughput and low latency is really important there, because users hate latency. They hate waiting for things to confirm. Mm-hmm. You'll end up just, even if you onboard users, if they have all these latency issues, you'll end up just losing a bunch of them who never come back. Yep. And then things like these human readable account names, like you want users to be able to interact with an application and send tokens to other users, not having to send them to these long strings of letters and numbers. I think the big one is no transaction fees. When you use, you know, Bitcoin or Ethereum or whatever it is, you pay for each sort of computation that you want to do on the network. And there's a cost there, and that cost can be variable depending on what the network congestion is like and some other factors. And I think, for you, there's a lot of applications that you want users who are just doing a bunch of actions in a row, and you don't want them to, one, you don't want to get a pop-up asking you to like pay for each individual one. But you also, there's like a mental cost. I think Nick Szabo has written about this to doing these like small transactions and having to pay a fee on each one. So I think like in particularly the like gaming space, it opens up a lot of possibilities because you could have things that actually exist on chain where you have, users like, you know, doing any sort of action and actually having that logged on chain, but not having to pay for it. I think another one is like any sort of decentralized social network where you have, like say that you had a decentralized version of Twitter and someone actually built this on Ethereum, is called PPETH, and it kind of got some usage for a while, but then kind of fell off. And to me, that wasn't super surprising because the user experience wasn't great. Like the interface was pretty good. Just sort of the interface and all that.
You had to pay to tweet, essentially, though, right?
Say it again?
You had to pay to, there was a paid element to it.
Pay to tweet, and then eventually they sort of bundled it, and you would do all these actions and then pay to have them like stamped on the blockchain as a whole. But either way, you still had to pay for that for sort of final settlement on the blockchain. Mm-hmm. And you're never going to get users to migrate to a platform where they have to pay for those kind of things. And so I think with having no individual transaction fees, that really opens up the design space for what you can do with a dApp. You can also have things like low stakes gambling. And like that's like the first use case we're really seeing blow up on EOS, where you have users who can do like a provably fair dice roll game, and they're only really betting with like a couple dollars worth of EOS, and you can do a bunch of those transactions in a row. Mm-hmm. Whereas potentially on other platforms, the cost per transaction would just make that extremely prohibitive. Mm-hmm. So, it's still very early on EOS. And I don't think like some of those use cases I talked about, like NFTs, we haven't really seen any big NFT projects. There's one called Monster EOS. It's kind of fun, kind of like a CryptoKitties type of thing. But I think we'll see more. And we haven't really seen any like social networks come on yet, but I think EOS as a platform makes more sense for those. And I certainly think we will see those. What we have seen take off is like the first use case that people really seem to be liking is these gambling applications. Yeah. And that, again, isn't super surprising to me. I mean, for like, that was the first thing that took off on Bitcoin for like a, from like Satoshi an application dice, perspective. Yeah. Yeah, exactly. And we're seeing it's literally dice games have been the first ones. Yeah. And so this isn't an endorsement of any of those games. Those are obviously, speculative and risky, and you can use a lot of money and get, they're like addictive and all that. But I do think it's really, really interesting to watch this ecosystem play out, because you've got these applications that, the levels of usability, I think, are very high, higher than what we've seen on other platforms. There's also like a mobile friendliness that EOS has found that I haven't seen with a lot of other platforms. Like a lot of these mobile wallets are really user friendly, and you can sign transactions with Touch ID, and you can actually use these dApps from within the mobile wallet. So things like EOS Links and Token Pocket and Scatter Mobile is coming out soon. So that's been really interesting. But I also think just watching this like open source competition for these gambling applications play out has been fascinating, because it sort of allows, these things are provably fair, but they have a house edge, and you're seeing all these competitors and clones pop up using other ways to try and incentivize users or outcompete the existing ones. And I think that we're going to see some pretty interesting like case studies over the next few months on EOS for how open source competition among dApps will play out. And like, will it be a race to the bottom with margins, or will there be other ways that they can sort of carve a moat around their users?
Totally. And one question, and I guess maybe this is like a first opportunity to address a little bit around block producers, and we'll get into, kind of exactly what you do as a block producer and kind of the value you bring to the network. But I think one of the big gambling, or probably one of the bigger gambling things was recently on Ethereum that got a ton of like press, was the proof of weak hands, or proof POW3HD or whatever the hell was. That got a ton of traction. And there was one thing, I think it was in like a Slack group that they had or something like that, where the admins had basically mentioned, why don't you run this on EOS? Because it would make maybe more sense to do this on EOS, because there's maybe a little bit less friction with the transaction costs and some of the other components of how they structured the game. And they had mentioned, I think specifically, it was like one of the admins, we'd be a little bit worried. I think I'm kind of paraphrasing this, but we'd be a little bit worried that the block producers wouldn't like what we're doing because it might be seen as a Ponzi scheme and they would shut us down. So could maybe you talk a little bit about governance from like a block producer perspective in regards to how something like that might function, that we can get into, some more details specifically around kind of what block producers do and you specifically as well.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I think the first thing is that the developers of Proof of Weak Hands 3D, I actually think that they're probably mistaken there. I mean, there's a big app that took off on EOS recently called Pixel Master that was literally like Satoshi's Place plus Proof of Weak Hands 3D, and was like a very similar scheme where you have to like buy out people's pixels if you want to draw on top of them and things like that. So it's sort of like, the market will test that hypothesis of theirs. We're going to see people build, and we already are seeing people build sort of proof of weak hands style games on EOS. And, thus far they haven't been shut down by block producers. The block producers it's not really like, I think people have this idea that like these block producers could just get together and decide, hey, we don't like this app or that app. It's really not that simple. These are different companies that are spread out all over the world in different jurisdictions. The people leading them have very different ideas about how EOS should work and what is good for the network and what isn't. And that's actually good because it kind of provides these like checks and balances. But also the what would be required for the block producers to effectively censor a dApp that was built on EOS would be that you would have to have 15 out of the top 21 simultaneously collude to censor transactions from that dApp. And those 15 out of 21 would have to maintain that position. And I think that the EOS community would be able to vote out block producers who were doing censorship. Mm-hmm. And I don't get the sense at all that the EOS community is in favor of having block producers decide which apps should be allowed on the platform and which ones shouldn't. Sure. And thus far that's what we've seen.
Sure. And you had kind of talked a little bit about, 15 out of 21 basically having to get together and collude. There was a whole big thing about EOS block producer collusion, I think recently. And I recall you might've written something about that. Would you mind explaining, what some of the rumor was there and just your overall like thought process on kind of what that situation was about?
Yeah. So there was a supposedly internal memo from one of the exchanges that was leaked. It was never verified. And at this point I'm going to lean towards saying that it probably wasn't real because, we never saw any verification of it there, but what was alleged, it wasn't like, per se, like malicious collusion, but mm-hmm. among block producers for censorship or anything like that. It was alleged that certain block producers were paying one another for votes, or essentially doing like vote sharing schemes where they're mm-hmm. saying, okay, you control X number of votes, I control X number of votes, we'll vote for each other. Or we control a bunch of votes, we'll vote for your block producer if you kick back, a certain portion of your proceeds to us. I've always said that like, all of these networks are political. They're political in different ways. And I do think that like delegated proof of stake is more political than some of these systems that have like off-chain governance or loosely coupled non-formalized governance, whatever you want to call it. You know, you have voting and you have nodes that are you know, profitable entities. So you're always going to have some level of people trying to do those things. And I think that you can't really prevent it, and you probably shouldn't waste too much energy trying to prevent it, because you're ultimately it's just going to be like a game of whack-a-mole. I think what you can do is focus on ways that make it less likely, less effective, you know, less profitable, and less likely to affect the security of the network. And the point that we're at right now is that there's not I think only about 25% of EOS token holders are actively voting. Mm-hmm. And so when you have a minority of users actually voting, then someone who's got a small stake, that if, you know, if 100% of people were voting, that would be a very small stake. Well, if only 25% are voting, then that's actually a much larger proportional stake. And that gives them thus a much larger sort of say over the governance of the network. And so I think one way that you combat this is to just try and increase total voter participation. And we wrote a blog post called Combating Vote Manipulation on EOS that dives into this. And I think it's just something that comes with the maturity of the network. We're very early with EOS, and people are still getting used to this idea of on-chain governance and either participating directly in voting or proxying your vote to a proxy. And I think as time goes on, more and more people who have like a vested long-term interest in EOS, whether those are crypto investors or dApps that have built on top of EOS or enterprises that have built on top of EOS, or just sort of like individual holders, those people are incentivized to keep EOS healthy. Whereas right now what you have is you have a lot of sort of speculators who are keeping their tokens on exchange and are really just speculating on a price increase in EOS, which is fine. You're always going to have speculators. But for example, some of the bigger dApps on EOS have for-profit business models, and they've generated a lot of EOS with their dApps. And so they've got, you know, large amounts of EOS in their accounts, and they're voting for block producers. And it's in their best interest to vote for block producers that are going to improve the network, because those dApps have built businesses that rely on EOS being successful. Mm-hmm. And it's the same thing if you were a long-term EOS token holder. If you're a crypto fund with a big position in EOS, and you want to see that value go up, you're incentivized to make sure that the network is healthy. There's a lot of people who still haven't made that leap yet, though. They think, hey, I just hold EOS and it doesn't matter what I do. So I think part of it is just educating people around this new idea of on-chain governance and voting and how they do that. And then the other part of it is the tools that make it easy to do that securely. And we're still not quite there yet. I mean, like Ledger just added EOS support. Mm-hmm. We're seeing more different types of wallets come online. But all these things are very new. So I think once we have really easy ways for people to vote securely, that's going to be another issue. I don't think voter apathy is the only issue here. I think UX is also a big issue.
Sure.
Sorry, I'll go ahead.
No, I was just going to say, I mean, as far as one thing you'd mentioned, obviously there's, it's interesting from, I guess, like, block producer standpoint, because there's obviously financial incentives to be a block producer and move up in the varying levels, I guess, in terms of, in terms of votes. You are a newer block producer on the scene in EOS. What are you doing in terms of like trying to add value to the EOS ecosystem? How is that going so far? Like, what have you learned around the process, along the process so far? Would love to hear your thoughts there.
Yeah, definitely. So yeah, we're one of the, we announced officially a little over a month ago, and we were one of the first block producers to actually announce our candidacy after the mainnet launch. A lot of the block producers who were around like in June, they're the ones you see in the top 21, the top 50 right now. And that's great. There's a lot of great ones who have done an amazing job. So we're fighting a little bit more of an uphill battle being a new block producer, but we did feel like there was room for more high quality block producers. you know, we felt that we could differentiate ourselves. So before I go into like what we're focusing on at Aurora, like the idea of a block producer is this very interesting business model, because it's really a two-part business model. One part is running the node and, you know, having the infrastructure, which is not trivial at all. You know, there's pretty significant infrastructure you need to run. And because EOS is so new and a lot of things are changing, you need to be on top of that. Mm-hmm. So that's one half of it. And then the other half is like, it can be any sort of business in the world that gets you votes. So, you know, some block producers have focused on building developer tools, and they're saying, you know, we're going to build the best developer tools. We're going to give them away for free. And that's going to get us votes. And so that's sort of going to be our business model, because, you know, once you get votes, that's how you make income. Other block producers have said, we're actually going to build dApps ourselves. That's going to be sort of our specialty. Others have taken like a sort of a community focus. So with Aurora, what we saw was that there was a lot of, I think, like confusion regarding EOS. There was a lot of really sort of like tough issues that EOS was facing, and a lot of changing things. And I spent, before I launched Aurora, I spent a really long time talking to like developers, talking to people in the EOS community, talking to people outside of the EOS community, talking to different businesses and funds, and kind of asking them like, you know, what are you interested in seeing out of block producers? What are your thoughts on the current state of EOS and all that? And I think consistently one of the things we heard was like, we'd like more sort of good insights onto, you know, what's happening with the platform. Because there was a lot of people who sort of bought into EOS maybe 6 months ago, 8 months ago, and haven't really followed all of the discussions that are happening within that core community. And that itself can be a full-time job. You know, there's like a million different Telegram chats happening. And that's just the Western community. And then there's the Eastern community, with a lot of that taking place on WeChat and in some of these other forums. And so we saw an opportunity to really like synthesize a lot of that information and package it and present it to the EOS community in a more digestible way. And so that's one part of it, is just keeping people up to date. But then the other part of it is that EOS is an on-chain governance system. And this is a very new thing, and we're trying to get people up to speed with that idea. And the you know, in order to have a healthy network with on-chain governance, you need to have people making informed voting decisions. So we want to provide the resources that are going to help people make informed decisions. Mm-hmm. So as people think about what's the best, you know, direction for the network to take, especially as we come up on some of these contentious issues around like, you know, the next version of the Constitution, or should this feature be added into the core protocol, or how should we be thinking about governance? How should we be thinking about standards? All of those things. We kind of wanted to take a leadership role within the community, providing really good insight into those things. And that's kind of what we have decided to focus on. So we, you know, at Aurora, we kind of pride ourselves on two things. One is running really, really great core infrastructure, really secure, really like low latency servers. And then on the other hand is having really good educational resources and, you know, providing community leadership on a lot of the sort of tough issues around EOS and providing insights there.
Awesome. Yeah, it's interesting. Appreciate the explanation. You know, kind of going back to the subject of dApps on EOS, I've seen this discussion a lot in a bunch of different like Telegrams and things like that.
But I know it's coming.
Yeah, oh, you know it's coming. So, you know, whether it's Dapp Radar or any of the other ones out there, you know, there's like Ethereum users and the transactions on Ethereum, and then there's now EOS and the transaction numbers and the user numbers, and a lot of it, like you said before, is these gambling sites. But there's a big debate, I think, as far as people accusing EOS or I guess, you know, users on EOS, whatever it might be, of basically faking user numbers on these dApps. Do you feel like that's, number one, is that happening? Is it natural growth? I would be interested to get your thoughts, because it's something I don't have a ton of expertise on.
Yeah. And so I'm happy to address that issue here, because I think it's like an arena where we can have like a productive conversation around it. I've kind of tried to like stay away from that conversation on Twitter now, because it becomes very toxic. And the truth is, at the end of the day, there's no way to actually prove these things. Mm-hmm. I mean, I don't necessarily know of anyone who's trying to do super in-depth analysis of on-chain data to gain any further insights. Maybe someone is. If you're out there, get in touch. I'd love to talk to you about it. But there's no real way to know, like, you know, is this 100% organic usage? Are some of the developers of these dApps, you know, creating a bunch of transactions? What is the incentive there? What would it cost them? It's hard to say exactly, but there's a few things to consider that are important. The first is that I invite any person who is sort of skeptical of EOS dApps being able to achieve high numbers of users to please, please, please sign up for an EOS account, create an EOS account, and go use one of these dApps. And you'll just see the level of usability is really, really, really impressive. The user experience is really, really impressive. It's probably like nothing you've ever experienced while using a decentralized application. And I think just taking that one simple step is enough to convince a lot of people, like, hey, this actually, maybe this makes sense that the users would gravitate towards these things because there's a great UX. And some of them are really fun. The other thing to consider is that, so a lot of the controversy has sort of centered around the number of transactions or the volume of transactions. Sure. And the fact that EOS has free individual transactions. So they're saying, you know, you can't look at these transaction numbers because it doesn't cost anything to make a transaction, and therefore this can be easily gamed. So that's not quite the case. As I mentioned, you don't pay for individual transactions in EOS, but what you do have is that your EOS stake entitles you to a certain portion of the network resources. So if I own 1% of EOS and I stake all of it, I am entitled to 1% of all the bandwidth of the network when it's at capacity. Mm-hmm. And so you can't, you know, transactions aren't exactly free in the sense that, you know, you as Bobby, I don't know if you own EOS or not, but say that you don't.
I do not.
Okay, yeah. So, you know, you can't go do a billion transactions a day because transactions are free without, you know, owning any EOS. And so that's one thing. Now there could certainly be really large EOS holders who are sending a bunch of transactions. We actually saw there was people were calling it like a network spammer, but it wasn't really a spammer because they were using bandwidth that they were entitled to. But they were just doing like a bunch of transactions on the network for a while. It was kind of like a stress test, and like that's fine. That's how the system is designed to work. Yeah. You have a claim on a certain amount of network resources, and no one can tell you that those are spam transactions or not, because you're sort of entitled to it. It's the same as if you were to do a bunch of transactions on Ethereum, and maybe they're dummy transactions or whatever, but you paid the gas, so yeah, you're entitled to those. And then the final thing is that the other metric that a lot of people are looking at is just the number of daily active users. And so the way that's calculated is just counting the number of individual accounts on EOS that interact with any dApp in a 24-hour period. Mm-hmm. And accounts on EOS are not free to create. You actually have to pay for the RAM costs of creating an account. Now, that cost has come down quite a bit. At the beginning of the network, the RAM price kind of went up, and accounts were quite expensive. But as it stands today, it's like $1.50 or something to create an account. So, you know, it's not free. It's not super expensive. Sure. And again, theoretically, some of these dApps could be paying to create a bunch of fake accounts and, mm-hmm. and manufacturing all of this data. But, you know, there's no way to know for sure. And I think when you go and you use these dApps, you'll see that they are really, they are fun. They are very usable, and it's not hard to believe that there's a lot of people using them. And then I think the final thing that I saw that I think is just a total nonsense argument is some people are like, well, you know, BetDice only has 1,500 followers on Twitter, and yet they claim to have 5,000 daily active users or something. Chinese users don't use Twitter. They also don't use Telegram. You probably shouldn't look at those numbers to get a sense of who their daily active users are. Most of this volume is coming from China. Most of the EOS activity in general is coming from China. I really think that a lot of people here in the West sort of underestimate how much popularity and sort of market penetration and development and usage EOS has in China. And they're a little bit, you know, they're kind of in a bubble a little bit living here, and maybe not seeing the Western crypto investors and commentators and all of that pay as much attention to EOS, but there's really a lot happening in China. And so given that all those users are out there, you're better off looking at, like, you know, how many people are in the BetDice WeChat group or something like that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, totally. It's been interesting to watch that, like, narrative slash argument develop around that. And I mean, it's almost like, if it's true, it's almost like exchange wash trading or something like that. If it's not true, then, and you know, the same could happen on Ethereum or a lot of these other networks, although it's, you know, more expensive because you're paying for the gas fees on Ethereum, and, you know, maybe the user experience is different. But it's kind of like interesting to think about how in some cases it, you know, if it's actually happening, it kind of equates to something like wash trading on these exchanges, where, you know, they were trying to generate basically fake volume to encourage people to come over there. You know, same could maybe be said about like a marketing tactic for DApp if it pops to the top of DApp radar or whatever it is. But yeah, like you said, it's tough to actually, you know, have any level of provability there.
Yeah, totally. And like that you're spot on. Like, it could be happening, and you could do it on Ethereum. It would cost a lot. Although, like I said, it's not exactly free to do it on EOS. Yeah. And it's kind of like, how much money are these DApps willing to burn to try to get those numbers up, and in order to sort of ultimately get more actual users and thus, you know, increase their profitability. But the reason I've kind of stopped participating in these discussions is that it's just not a productive argument. Mm-hmm. You're just going to go back and forth, and I could tell you all the reasons why it's probably not fake, and you could tell me all the reasons why it probably is. At the end of the day, I'd rather just like focus on, you know, helping improve EOS to the point where, you know, that these dApps do continue to attract real organic growth. And at some point that will start to speak for itself. At some point there, I think the numbers will be such that you can't really claim that they're fake. But it's just not a super productive discussion at this point.
Yeah, totally. And one of the other things outside of, I think you created it when you were at Multicoin, and outside of, you know, your work on EOS, you created the stablecoin index. Yeah. Obviously, a lot of stuff with stablecoins happening recently. Would love your take on just some of the recent developments in like the stablecoin world. Any like just thoughts off the top of your head as far as stablecoins go, with the fiat-backed stablecoins and, you know, all the additions to the exchanges and things like that?
Yeah, I mean, to be honest, like, so I've been interested in stablecoins for a long time. I think my first reason for being interested in them was having lived in Argentina, and I was like, oh, it would be useful for people to have permissionless decentralized currencies that also have the price stability of a dollar, because I saw that there was a ton of demand for dollars in Argentina. There was not a ton of demand for Bitcoin, because people wanted value stability. But then I also became interested in stablecoins as we saw like the rise of Ethereum and other smart contract platforms, because it was like, oh, if you want to interact with dApps, you know, make payments and things like that, it's just a lot more useful to do it with a unit of account that you're familiar with. And certainly for a lot of like users who, again, aren't crypto native, they'd prefer that. But that being said, I've been super surprised by this like explosion of stable coins recently. Like the fact that it happened now in the bear market, like, and the fact that they're all like fiat backed is just like, it's been very interesting to me. I definitely am more interested in decentralized stablecoins. Mm-hmm. I think the most interesting things about stablecoins is that you could combine the permissionless properties of something like Bitcoin with the value stability of a fiat currency like the US that traditionally has been relatively stable. There are uses for fiat-backed stablecoins. Mm-hmm. You know, as we've seen like with Tether, like traders get a lot of use out of it. I actually saw something on Twitter recently. I forget who said it. Maybe it was Hasufly, but I can't remember. But they proposed calling fiat-backed stablecoins fiat coins instead of stablecoins.
I remember that. You know, I don't remember who it was, but I remember seeing that tweet as well.
Yeah, and I was like, you know what? I actually think that's like a kind of a good distinction. Like, I wrote about stablecoins when I was at Multicoin, and one of the first things I tried to do was like create categories of stablecoins for people mm-hmm. to think about, because it is a very broad category, but they're also super different in terms of the model that you take. Yeah. And so I kind of classified them into like fiat backed, crypto collateralized, and like algorithmic mm-hmm. or like senior shares. But the difference between those three models is actually very significant.
Yeah,
and I do like the idea of calling them fiat backed, because it's a much different type of thing that you're doing. It's literally just an IOU that is sort of digital and can live on top of a blockchain. And that's probably useful for certain things. But I am more interested in the decentralized stablecoin side of things overall.
Yeah.
I think there's just a lot more to unpack there that's really interesting.
Yeah, I think that's kind of like I think where a lot of my just interest in general lies, because I, you know, for the most part, like the fiat coins or the fiat back coins, whatever you want to call them, like we kind of know for the most part they're going to work, at least especially if it's supposed to be like the Gemini or the USDC, like
totally, yeah,
that should very much have a dollar for every dollar basically audited, etc. But like we don't necessarily know if the, you know, if the dyes or if the basises or the carbons or, you know, whatever, or the, you know, the algorithmic stable coins, like we don't necessarily know if those are going to work in every single scenario. It'd be awesome if they do. It'd be interesting. It'd be an interesting case study if they don't. So I feel like that's going to be interesting to watch that scenario play out, more so than just knowing that the fiat coins are basically going to be a dollar.
Totally. And like, I think there's like Tushar from Multicoin talks a lot about like the, like a trade-off space within within the crypto industry for like a lot of different things. Like there's Vitalik's famous scalability trilemma, which is like a trade-off between these different properties. And it's the same thing with stable coins. Like when you're talking about fiat backed versus decentralized, like there's just big trade-offs there with the fiat backed, you're like leveraging existing legal primitives kind of to guarantee that those things are actually backed and thus should trade at a tight peg. Whereas with the decentralized ones, you're kind of leveraging new technological primitives to get cool properties. Do you have strong thoughts on like the DAI, the sort of the collateral backed like DAI model versus the algorithmic like basis model?
I don't have incredibly strong thoughts yet. I feel like it should be interesting to see like once Basis goes live. I feel like they had a ton of backing and like a ton of respect in the industry, although it's been fairly cool to see DAI like for the most part succeed and maintain peg, going from ETH at $1,200 to ETH at $200 right now, and not completely blow up. I think that would have obviously been not the greatest, not the greatest innovation for the Ethereum community and for the, you know, collateralized stable community. But I'm curious to see which one. I feel like one is going to win out, but I do think too, like it's, when you look at like the DAI versus the USDC or the GUSDC, I think that, you know, seeing some of the, you know, people have examined the smart contracts and basically see you can, you know, there's a reason those are the fiat coins are on all the exchanges or getting to all the exchanges, is because they basically are compliant, because they can freeze the accounts, they can pause the accounts. Whereas, you know, there's certain benefits to a DAI or to some of these other ones where, you know, that is, it's actually significantly more decentralized. So like you said, there are heavy trade-offs to the different models for sure.
Yeah. I'm like curious if like 5 years from now or 10 years from now, you know, choose one, if there will be more demand for the fiat backed stable coin or the decentralized stable coin, right? Cause like the demand is coming from different places. You could say that like if dApps really take off, then probably there will be more demand for the decentralized stable coins because they kind of require that permissionless, stable coin to exist within them. Or, you know, there's some people who think dApps are never going to really take off, but, you know, trading will always be a thing. So maybe there will be more demand for those, or maybe we'll see the fiat-backed stable coins actually be used in ways that we don't expect right now. Like, people in countries like Argentina or Venezuela or something will actually be able to get their hands on them and will actually start using them and won't get their accounts frozen.
Yeah.
Or is the fact that there even is that backdoor enough to make people, you know, never fully get on board with those? I don't really know.
Yeah.
But I mean, I've kind of been a like a spectator of the stablecoin space. I don't have any investments in any stablecoin projects. Not that I don't think there's really great ones out there. I just sort of like, I prefer to just watch from afar and sort of watch that ecosystem play out. And that was kind of what motivated doing the stablecoin index. And shameless plug right here. I started working with an awesome developer named Mike McDonald. He built mkr.tools. If you're familiar with that site, it's like the data visualizer for everything going on in the Maker ecosystem, all the CDPs and things like that. And he's been creating an entirely new front end for the stablecoin index. We're going to open source the whole thing. We're going to add in all the new stable coins, the recent ones that have come out, and we're going to be going live with that like within the next week or so. And the idea behind that is that, you know, there are all these new stable coins. We're kind of at the point where there's like a bunch of them launching. They're all going to compete, and I'm sure it's eventually going to consolidate into like a few winners.
Yeah.
And, you know, hopefully that site can be a resource for people who are interested in how that plays out.
Yeah, you were definitely ahead of the curve with the stablecoin index in the past month. The value of that site's gone up quite a bit. But I mean, as we're kind of coming to the end of the conversation here, maybe is there anything I didn't touch on in regards to, you know, Aurora or just your work in the EOS ecosystem, stablecoins in general, the crypto industry in general? Would love to, you know, if there's anything you'd like to finish off with, would love to touch on that.
I mean, the one thing that loops them both together is that I recently saw on GitHub, someone like dug up some stuff. Dan Larimer from Block One, who, you know, created the EOS and was like the pioneer behind BitUSD, sort of drafted up a new proposal for like a stablecoin model that's actually much different from anything I've ever seen. So I don't know if you do like show notes or something like that, but I can send you the link.
Yeah, shoot me over the link, and then I can definitely include it in the notes.
Yeah, I was reading through that, and I thought it was actually a really interesting model. So I'm waiting to see stablecoins go live on EOS. Mm-hmm. There aren't any right now. Haven, which has built a stablecoin on Ethereum, is going to also launch a stablecoin on EOS. And I wouldn't be surprised if some of these other projects try and kind of go cross chain, but I think that the sort of we're seeing the DApp ecosystem develop really fast on EOS, and so it would be really great to have a stablecoin on EOS that could plug into all those existing DApps. And I think I have no doubt that that will happen. I just don't know how soon it'll be.
Yeah.
If there's any developers out there who are working on EOS stablecoins, please get in touch. We'd love to talk to you. But I'm definitely excited about that coming online. What else? I would say that, you know, if people are, I think I would encourage people to have an open mind with EOS and to really just go out there and play around with some of the stuff that's built there. Because I think there's a lot of really cool things happening, and you know, there's a ton of activity on EOS, a ton of activity in China. I think it's absolutely an ecosystem that's worth paying attention to. And then, you know, if anyone is sort of already onboarded onto EOS and wants to dive a lot deeper, that's what we're trying to do at Aurora. So if people are interested in like learning more about the platform on a much deeper level or talking about issues around governance and things like that, they should check out our blog.
Awesome. Yeah. I'll link to your Twitter profile and the blog and the show notes and all that good stuff. But really appreciate you taking the time. You know, this was definitely helpful for me just to get a little bit more context. Because like I said, kind of kicking off the show, I certainly have a degree of ignorance with EOS in general, and just, you know, have a lot of the, you know, kind of just collective perception. So hearing from somebody who has experience with a number of different ecosystems and is now focusing in this one specifically, it's cool and definitely helpful for me to understand and kind of round out my knowledge. So I appreciate you coming on.
Yeah, absolutely. Thanks for
and having me. Yeah, it was awesome. And we'll have to get another steak at some point in time soon, man.
Yeah. Well, this one, next time you're in Austin, I'll make you that steak that I told you about at the beginning of the episode.
that definitely works. Well, appreciate the time, man. Thank you so much.
All right. Thanks, Bobby.